Good morning. Back in September, Paul Jagot observed, "You can't say that Al Gore hasn't learned from Bill Clinton. Among other things, he's figured out that every 4 years a Democratic presidential candidate needs a good Puritan makeover." That is the key to understanding Mr. Gore's latest amazing reincarnation as a 21st century Cotton Mather. Religion and its emphasis on character was as prominent as ever for the American elections, not more so in this campaign. At the beginning of our recent campaign, the Republican pre-primary debate contenders offered something close to altar calls, with George Bush confessing that Jesus Christ was the most influential political philosopher for him. And shortly after the beginning of the new year, the most highly pitched battle within the Republican primary was whether or not W. should speak at Bob Jones University. That led to John McCain's repudiation of the Christian right and its consequent backfire. Discussion of religiously tinged social issues such as capital punishment, homosexuality, abortion, and school prayer was a frequent staple of this year's elections. At federal, state, and national levels, religion was paramount, and few issues were more pervasive. This year's Democratic Convention also sought to present its members as the champions of religious fervor. Candidate Lieberman talked more about his faith than any evangelical since Pat Robertson in 1988. Is that me?
No, I don't think that's you.
That's the Democrats. That's the Democrats, okay. It is a challenge to try to have the prescience that Elizondo's had in planning this meeting. Just prior to the Democratic Convention, meanwhile, President Clinton was confessing his, well, we're not exactly sure what, at Willow Creek Church, and it took a full month until the Weekly Standard's Andrew Ferguson would adequately critique that moment, while many naive evangelicals fawned over his fall confession. Still eager to play the Cotton Mather, Vice President Gore canned Representative Loretta Sanchez's Playboy fundraiser in August because of its setting. And the final campaign from Labor Day on saw many expressions of overt religion, with Joseph Lieberman on one occasion equating environmentalism with orthodoxy, and last weekend Al Gore using religion to inspire African American church voters to overcome evil with good, supposedly by voting for him. Exit polling data for religious interest groups indicates that the Roman Catholic vote was nearly split and that nearly 4 out of 5 evangelicals supported Bush, a reversal of the Clintonian gains in 1992 and 1996 among that segment, and a return to levels of support given to Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Frequency of church attendance across denominational lines predicted support for George Bush. Yes, religion was a large part of this presidential campaign, big time, as eventual Vice President Richard Cheney might say. It was as large and as overt as any time since 1976, and probably not excessively so, probably for a very good reason and a corollary. The reason is that character is reassured by true faith, and to the degree that character is in question, its validation by religion or some authority necessarily increases. That is my thesis, but I hope to reacquaint this audience in a postmodern era with a few salient observations about the customary role of religion in American politics, especially during and leading up to the founding period. Of course, there are many other periods we would like to cite. As a historian, I would like to talk about some of the 19th century reoccurrences of evangelical involvement in religion. When, for example, the Democrats in the 33rd Congress wailed that it took on the semblance of an ecclesiastical council more than that of a legislative assembly, with its members, as many of them who were ministers saw themselves as vice-regents of the Almighty in a left-handed attempt to put the state in subordination to the dictates of the church. You see, the expression of religion is not new in American history. We are sometimes not always as mindful as we should be of it, but it has a long and distinguished history, even studying into the 19th century, a full century after the founders, and I'll probably just leave this point there. You can find a continuing shadow of the impress of evangelicals in the secular square. And indeed, in this past week, those evangelicals who went to the polls in the toss-up states of Florida, Arkansas, Missouri and my own state of Tennessee, where over half of our voters retaliated against their favorite stepson because of his boss's misbehavior, the evangelical vote was as important as ever. That being said, however, I'd like to spend most of my time on the period I've been assigned, and that is the 1760s through the 1780s. On May 31st, 1780, the Reverend Simeon Howard, the pastor of Boston's West Church, addressed the Massachusetts House of Representatives, and what he did may shock contemporaries. He addressed this House of Representatives before the Honorable Council, and he chose to discuss the character that is necessary for governors by expounding upon a covenantal passage in the Old Testament from the book of Exodus, chapter 18. And the text was this to the House of Representatives: "But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials." Howard thought that the phrase "capable men" implied at least that the public leaders would be men who would hazard their lives in the defense of the public. Non-self-serving leadership was called for, and they were to be leaders whose bodies and minds had not been broken by, quote, "the effeminating pleasures of luxury, intemperance, or dissipation." Public leaders were also to fear God. If not, when pressured by various seductive interests, they might too easily compromise if devoid of a sense of the eternal. Howard asked, and I find this quote very relevant not only for ballot supervisors today, but for electors. Howard asked, "But suppose this person in a situation where he apprehends that temporal infamy and misery will be a certain consequence of his practicing virtue. Can we expect that he will adhere to his duty? Will he sacrifice everything dear in this life in the cause of virtue when he has no expectation of any reward for it beyond the grave? Will he deny himself a present gratification without any prospect of being repaid either here or in the hereafter? Will he expose himself to reproach, poverty, and death for the sake of doing good to mankind without any regard to God as the rewarder of virtue or punisher of vice?" Howard, typical of many of the founders, did not believe that our leaders would act justly and for virtue if they did not have a certain sense of the eternal. Howard preached that a man governed by his appetite will be guilty of any enormity for the sake of gratifying it. The indulgence of this vice debases the mind and renders it incapable of anything generous and noble, destroys the principles of benevolence, friendship, and patriotism, and gives a tincture of selfishness to all its sentiments. It blinds and perverts the judgment and disposes it to confound truth and falsehood, right and wrong. Howard warned, much like the Protestant reformers before him, and particularly much like Samuel Rutherford, that the magistrate is properly the trustee of the people. He can have no just power but what he receives from them, and to them he ought to be accountable for the use of this power that he uses. This is Old Testament covenantal theology surfacing in early American politics, and there were many other sermons that regularly address the character that should be possessed among the leaders of colonial America. One such sermon was Samuel Cook's 1770 sermon, and of it, one historian has said, many of the principles on which the Declaration of Independence rests are already here in 1770. Civil government is an ordinance of God. Only the people have the right to choose who will rule them. Government must contain a balance of power with built-in checks. People have a right to good government. A ruler will not forget that his subjects are by nature equal to himself. The people will be subjected to no restrictions not founded on reason. Laws must be clear and explicit. After Boston's Tea Party and before the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, a host of sermons prepared a people in utero. Indeed, because of the pioneering work of early leaders who were quite religious and covenantal, the clergy were actually in advance of the civil authorities in their views. In his 1966 work, Harvard historian Alan Heimert contended that the founding era's Federalist Republican literature was based not so much on Enlightenment premises as in 18th century religion, its homiletics as well as its doctrines. His study led him to conclude that the contribution of 18th century Calvinism to the making of the American public mind has been allowed to remain unappreciated. And yet these Calvinistic roots for the politics of covenant theology preceded the social contract. The forerunners of the American Revolution assumed Calvin's view of depravity and moved logically then to limit government scope. That is covenant. That is character, limited by the covenant. And perhaps in our Q&A session, I can give a few comments on one of the finest illustrations that is the hottest topic on CNN, an attempt to give a Calvinistic rationale for the Electoral College. Samuel Adams's Calvinism frequently animated him, and the preaching of the day has been described in this way. The Bible was raked with a fine Calvinistic comb for every quotation seeming to give divine sanction for resistance to Great Britain. The Puritan Calvinistic clergy, according to an earlier study, had a large part in planting the predominant American political ideas which were antagonistic to those dominant in England. The spirit of fierce liberty the dissenting clergy communicated to people far more influenced them in what they heard in the house of God than in what we have been recently taught. Other sermons a generation before the American Declaration and Revolution reinforced that political tradition which came from Calvin's Geneva. This pre-declaration period, John Adams himself noted, was the period when the minds and hearts of the people were persuaded before a drop of blood was shed. The sermons and those discussions for which we're so indebted to Ellis Sandoz in his wonderful reprint from 1760 to 1775 reveal the formative impact of the Huguenot ideals on the American Revolution, and the beginning of New England is therefore long prior to the shot heard round the world. American preaching in the first half of the 18th century was quick to revert to the political themes of earlier covenant theology. And let me give a short definition of that. The covenant theology is the idea that God makes a covenant with a federated group and holds the community responsible for obedience in terms that were stipulated by that covenant. Don't forget that the Latin fetus, from which we get our word federal, is the word for covenant. And so our covenant theology is interwoven if we understand our history and its etymology. The influence of this tradition on the founding of America cannot be ignored without misunderstanding America's origin any more than ignoring religion today can adequately explain our politics. The more one studies such sermons, the more one realizes that it was neither miracle nor accident that at the end of the century, Americans were able to create a workable constitution. Sermons like these surely played a role in making New Englanders politically alert and critical when the need came to make a constitution and have it ratified. There existed already in the Puritan colonies the tradition of close scrutiny on the nature of government. Now, this ready appropriation of the name and of the covenant of Old Testament Israel to America and those contexts in the 18th century was typical of areas dominated by the Protestant Reformation. The challenge is to understand how and why the founders of America applied numerous Old Testament texts to their own political landscape before evaluating its merit. From the Reformation to the American founding, a consistent application of Israeli political norms is evidence. Not only Zwingli and Calvin, but most of the continental reformers thought that the revelation of God to Israel was pertinent to matters in Switzerland, Germany, France, Holland, Scotland, and England. That idea, of course, sailed over with the Puritans to Plymouth. John Winthrop, the first and leading governor of Massachusetts Bay, relied on these same Old Testament passages and applied those to his colony. The earliest colony of Massachusetts, the council, limited itself by this default rule in one of our premier constitutional documents in Massachusetts Bay. They wrote that in cases, this is a default law, in cases where there is no particular express law provided, they are to be guided by the word of God until the general court gives rules in particular cases. And most of those rules, as you know, were taken from Old Testament case laws in the Book of the Covenant from Exodus 21 through 23. The extent to which these earlier New Englanders followed Old Testament patterns, being unwilling to form governments based on their own notions or agreements alone, is seen in this code's stipulation to have judges in each town as in ancient Israel. Apparently, they saw no reason not to apply Old Testament texts to the formation of their own governments. The covenant was very vital in early American political documents. As an interesting multicultural experiment, let me just mention too that in 1651, one of John Cotton's contemporaries, John Eliot, gathered together several congregations of American Indians in a small community in Natick, Massachusetts. And first he began a translation of the Bible into their languages, and the second thing he did was to organize them into a body politic, as he described it, using the verses in Exodus chapter 18, that passage that has been so relied on in history by Calvin, Althusius, and George Buchanan. These early Indian Republicans then chose leaders, exactly as Exodus 18 says, leaders of hundreds, fifties, and tens, just as the Mosaic pattern described. In clearly covenantal language that was more akin to the language of Canaan and Calvin's Geneva than to modern Washington or Paris, and fraught with phrases that would become commonplaces, they affirmed this covenant in the mid-17th century, and they saw themselves as sons of Adam. Such fiery preaching with such unambiguous theological conviction was the kind sponsored by the early congressional fast and Thanksgiving services. Library of Congress historian James Hudson comments that for a decade from the first proclamation of a national fast, Congress adopted and preached to the American people the political theology of the national covenant, the belief that the war with Britain was God's punishment for America's sins, and the national confession and repentance would reconcile him to the country, cause him to bear his mighty arm and smite the British. Hudson says covenant theology had legitimized this approach for generations. So have other scholars. Donald Lutz, for example, claims that by 1641, much of what will become American constitutional government is already operating under the earlier foundational documents. From the middle of the 17th century until the American Revolution, American clergymen had been declaring that citizens were given inalienable rights of life, liberty, and property. Slowly and inexorably, a political tradition was growing on American soil, and the significance cannot be overemphasized. Alice Baldwin, in a 1928 work that I commend to you, The New England Clergy and the American Revolution, that's largely out of print, said that there is not a right asserted in the Declaration of Independence which had not been discussed by the New England clergy before 1763. This particular hermeneutic was dominant in American political thought in our founding period, and whether one agrees with that or not, viewing the nation as heir to Israel's political promise seems to be a legitimate part of our history. And moreover, I'll close with one remaining tangent, that the separation of church and state was not as inflexible as our previous century thought is vindicated by a perusal of the fast and Thanksgiving proclamations in the journals of the Continental Congress. Now, I've given you the Reader's Digest version of those in my invocation last night. The remainder of these will be posted on the website following. But could I just give you one example of that? In the fast proclamation on June of 1775, Congress called not only for a moment of silence, but for a day of public humiliation, fasting, and prayer. The specific aim was to confess and deplore our many sins, an idea far from today's purely secular worldview, and to beseech God to forgive our iniquities. God's providence was mentioned no less than four times in that single bill, and God was described by that Congress as possessing immutable justice, again a far cry from muted religion or agnosticism. Besides praying for the people's representatives who met in assembly, this proclamation also specifically asked its citizens to pray, quote, that the virtue and true religion may revive and flourish throughout our land, and that God would graciously interpose to restore invaded rights. That this proclamation was incompatible with deism or agnosticism, much less the many forms of rigid separationism, may be seen from its conclusion, urging that, quote, Christians of all denominations assemble for public worship and abstain from servile labor and recreations on the said day the Congress declared a Sabbath in Old Testament fashion, even employing phrasing contained from the Westminster Confession of Faith and other Puritan thoughts. Well, there are more of those you could study, and I must bring my talk to a conclusion. From a study of these proclamations, of the sermons, from the other bills that were approved by Congress, including those that approved chaplaincies, the printing of Bibles, prayers, and seals, and the evidences of religious expression from the state charters of the period. You should review the South Carolina Charter in 1778 to see their view of religion. All point to this. The wall of separation was not stacked too highly with bricks, 20th century thought notwithstanding. American orators in the Revolutionary period still identified America with the new Israel, far from being a secular errand in the wilderness, as claimed by some after-the-fact revisionists. They saw God's providence in daily events, hardly based on pluralistic models. American colonists had a strong religious identity. And the only reason, I'll add in closing, that the free interplay between religion and politics is either noticed or attributed as unprecedented in our own time is because we have endured and are likely resurfacing from an atypical period of history, an anomaly, if you will. Our toleration, in other words, is so low that when the slightest exposure comes upon us, we seem like bats exiting a cave at noon and are only relatively blinded. However, when measured by a longer stretch of our own history, such exposure is neither deserving of the Surgeon General's warning, nor is it abnormal. Perhaps we can love the return to normalcy. The religion of the founders worked, and worked vitally for them, and it should not shock us that a return to pristine beauty is as healthy as it is aesthetically pleasing. The covenant is still needed for our character.